you are listening to Based in Fact, a true crime podcast. Join host Lisa O'Brien and Kyle Evans as they examine America's most infamous true crime cases as they were established in our courts and the basis for the decisions of the appeals courts, not the court of public opinion. Here's Lisa and Kyle.
Welcome to season 3 of Based in Fact, a true crime podcast. We're your hosts, Lisa O'Brien and Kyle Evans, and this is episode 2, State of Maryland versus James Allen Kulbicki. Kulbicki was convicted for the 1993 murder of his former girlfriend, Gina Marie Newelson, who was seeking court-ordered child support for their son. We'll talk about the twists and turns in Kulbicki's case, including the reinstatement of his conviction by the U.S. Supreme Court and the 2020 order of the Maryland Court of Appeals granting Kulbicki's petition for writ of actual innocence. And welcome back, Kyle. Good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
Very well. Now, in advance, I'm going to say that I am more likely than not going to be mispronouncing this family name. I believe that it's Newelson, but I have not been able to find anything where it's pronounced like by a news story or any of that stuff. All the links that I found for news stories from 1994, 1995 are all dead links. So I'm flying blind. I took German, but I don't think that the way it's pronounced in German is the way that the family actually pronounced it. So if anyone from the family or involved with the case is listening, my apologies in advance if I'm not pronouncing the family's last name correctly. The victim in this case is Gina Marie Newelson. She was born May 15th, 1970. I believe she was born in Baltimore, Maryland. But this is a pre-internet case, so there's not a lot of information or biographical information about her available, readily available online. Her parents were Joseph Charles Newelson III, who died in 2019, and her mother was Geraldine Gearhart Newelson, who died in 2022. Gina had sisters named Eve and Jennifer, and I believe that she was the older sister, and Eve and Jennifer were the middle and youngest sisters. Gina did graduate high school. However, while she was in high school, she started working. She lived with her parents and was probably wanting to help make ends meet. So she worked, and she was a waitress and a clerk at a convenience store. Her son, Michael Joseph Newelson, was born September 13th, 1991, and her cause of death was a gunshot wound to the head. The perpetrator in this case is James Allen Kulbicki. He was born September 18, 1956. I also believe he was born in Baltimore or somewhere within the surrounding area of Baltimore. He was married to Constance Kulbicki. He had a son, Allen, who was born June 17, 1984. He also had a stepson named Daryl. He is... From everything I've read about him and a lot of the things I've seen about the case, this is my armchair psychiatrist diagnosis of Mr. Kulbicki. He is dishonest, he's abusive, he's controlling and domineering, and he's manipulative. And his victim, of course, is Gina Marie Newelson. The crime occurred on January 9th, 1993. At age 16, Gina worked an overnight shift as a waitress at Horn & Horn in Baltimore. That's where she met 30-year-old Baltimore City police officer James Allen Kobicki. The two claim that their affair didn't start until the fall of 1990 when Gina was 19. Gina lived with her parents and worked multiple jobs to help make ends meet. She was also a big sister to Eve and Jennifer. Their whirlwind relationship began with the lie that Kobicki was single. In fact, he was married, the father of a young son and stepfather to his wife's teenage son. In early 1991, Gina found out she was pregnant. Kobicki pressured her to abort the child. He also admitted that he was still married. Unwilling to make her parents bear financial responsibility for her child, Gina sought public assistance, and in May of 1992, she filed a paternity suit in Baltimore City Circuit Court to obtain child support from Kobicki. This also was probably because she was seeking public assistance, Medicaid benefits for Michael, that she had no choice. Kobicki denied paternity and lied about having sex with Gina. A city paternity prosecutor described him as the most difficult person she'd ever encountered. Kobicki rejected the initial paternity test results, demonstrating a 99% probability that he was Michael's father. He claimed that this was only because he and Gina shared similar ethnic backgrounds and demanded a second paternity test, which was done by Johns Hopkins, and yielded the same results. Kobicki was determined by DNA testing to be Michael's father. When their relationship ended in April of 1991, Gina was left to raise their son on her own. Michael Joseph Nielsen was born in September 1991. After Michael's birth, Kobicki visited Gina and Michael at her parents' home, and they resumed their sexual relationship. In October 1992, Gina found out she was pregnant, but chose to terminate that pregnancy. A final hearing in the support action was scheduled for January 13th, 1993. At that time, the state intended to seek a lump sum arrearage payment of $3,000, and Kobicki had been ordered to bring a check to the hearing. Future support would also be set, and those monthly payments would be garnished from Kobicki's paychecks.
So, sorry, I'm trying to track. Mm-hmm. Did she have one kid with him?
She had one kid with him.
And
yes.
Then aborted the second one?
And then did not follow through with the second one.
Gotcha.
And more likely than not, this was probably because he was probably making empty promises to help her support Michael and not following through.
All right.
She had started this action for paternity. He denied being the father of Michael. He denied ever having sex with her. He tried to say she was some kind of badge bunny. So he was basically demeaning her.
Right.
To anyone who would listen, and calling her crazy and you know, lying through his fucking teeth. So, you know, that was, she didn't want to have a second child with this deadbeat loser. And that's not, you know, not an unreasonable thing to do. When he pressured her to have an abortion when she was initially pregnant with Michael, that wasn't something that she wanted to do at that time. So she didn't do it. But then when with the prospect of a second child with this loser, she didn't want to go through that. So,
got it.
I imagine the family was probably pretty devout Catholic, so this was not an easy decision for her to make. But it was a decision that she felt was best for her at that time. So Kobicki had been pressuring Gina to drop the paternity and support claim, but she refused. As I said earlier, she may not have had a choice, because in a lot of these state paternity support cases, the mother is the nominal plaintiff, but the actual plaintiff is the state. And the state is seeking support not only to cover child support to the mother, but to reimburse the state for any Medicaid or other state benefits that the child receives from the state. Although it's likely that Kulbicki made promises to do the right thing and help her financially, it's no wonder that she didn't trust a man who'd been lying to her since the day they met. Whether for purposes of intimidation or jealousy, Kulbicki also began stalking Gina during the fall of 1992. On January 8, 1993, Gina arrived for her shift at a convenience store in a dark truck. She was upset and had a red mark on her face that looked like the imprint of three fingers. When her friend Andy picked her up from work that night, Gina pointed out Kulbicki's truck parked near the store. Later that night, Gina's family saw the truck near the house, and Gina appeared afraid. On the afternoon of January 9, 1993, Gina left her parents' house at 3:30 p.m. to walk to work, where she was scheduled at 4 p.m. On January 10, 1993, at 8 a.m., her body was found in Gunpowder State Park by a man walking his dog. Because of their relationship and the paternity support suit, Kulbicki was questioned. He lied to detectives, denying a sexual relationship with Gina and paternity of Michael. Kulbicki also lied about his alibi and claimed he didn't believe in DNA testing. Detectives seized his truck and searched his home, where they found a denim jacket with bloodstains on one sleeve. They also seized a .38 caliber off-duty weapon. Although the outside of Kulbicki's truck was filthy, the interior appeared to have been recently cleaned. In spite of that, blood and bone fragments missed during the cleaning process were found in the truck. Genetic testing on the blood and bone fragments excluded Kulbicki as their source, but did not exclude Gina. The blood on Kulbicki's jacket was also tested and did not exclude Gina. Finally, a witness came forward placing Kulbicki in Gunpowder State Park on the afternoon of January 9th, 1993. Kulbicki was arrested in Baltimore County by Baltimore County authorities on January 12th, 1993. And just a note for listeners, there's Baltimore City Police and then there's Baltimore County Police. And if I recall correctly, they don't always play well with each other. So, and Baltimore City's, their jurisdiction is, you know, within Baltimore City, and Baltimore County generally is responsible for the communities in the suburban areas outside of Baltimore City.
Right. More of the outlying areas.
Correct. And Kulbicki was indicted on February 8, 1993 for murder in the first degree and use of a handgun in the commission of a felony. He was bonded out by his mother, Florence, on January 26, 1993. And a gentleman by the name of Henry Belsky served as pretrial counsel, and the judge was Barbara K. Howe. This was in Baltimore County Circuit Court. His trial was held before Judge Grayson Turnbull, or John Grayson Turnbull. He was represented by Mr. Belsky and Patricia C. Hall, who served as second chair. Now, this is something I generally don't go into too much detail about the trial, but in this particular case, I feel it's warranted because Kulbicki orchestrated an attempt to taint the proceedings. It's nothing more. I mean, it can't be anything other than that. It's not innocent. It's not accidental. It's not unintentional. He wanted to taint the proceedings, and this is how he wanted it done. During his case in chief, his stepson, Daryl, who lived with appellant, testified that he was angry with Ms. Nielsen because she had an affair with appellant while appellant was married to his mother. He further testified that he did not recall where he was on January 9th and that both he and appellant occasionally wore the bloodstained blue denim jacket that was seized from appellant's home. On cross-examination, he testified that he did not remember whether he was at home on January 9th or whether he was using appellant's pickup truck at 3:30 p.m. on that day. Believing that appellant was attempting to use Daryl's testimony to create the impression that Daryl may have been responsible for the murder, the state then asked Daryl whether he killed Miss Nielsen. Daryl refused to answer, and despite the court's warning that he would be held in contempt of court if he did not answer, he again refused to answer when asked the question a second time. As a result, the judge excused the jury from the courtroom and again threatened to hold Daryl in contempt of court if he did not answer the question. When the jury returned, the state asked the question a third time, and Daryl replied that he did not kill Gina. In rebuttal to Daryl's testimony, the state presented the testimony of Melody Jakowski and Deborah Dean, two of Daryl's co-workers at the Greenery Extended Care Nursing Home. Over Kolbicki's objections, they testified in effect that Daryl told them that he intended to confess falsely that he killed Gina, thereby exonerating appellant. According to their testimony, Daryl then said that when he was on trial for the murder, appellant would admit to killing Gina, thereby exonerating Daryl. Daryl believed that the double jeopardy clause would then prevent or prohibit the state from prosecuting either of them for the murder a second time. So this is not, and I've heard in an interview somewhere when Kolbicki was confronted with this, I've heard him try to explain that this was just a way for him to try to get the cops to actually investigate the murder. Now, that's not the time to do it. You're on trial for the murder. You've been arrested. You've been indicted. You're on trial. Having your stepson make a false confession on the stand is not the time for this bullshit. The time for this bullshit is in an interview with the police before you're even arrested for the murder. But, you know, Daryl had no motive to kill Gina, and there's no evidence that he even knew who Gina was.
Right, just one of those random kind of fake suspects that everybody believes, even though there's no reason to.
And it's very unlikely that if he had pulled up in the truck and told her to get in, she probably would have told him to go pound sand.
Right.
Because she didn't know who he was.
Exactly.
So anyway, well, that ploy didn't work. And on October 20th, 1993, Kolbicki was found guilty. And he was formally sentenced to life without parole plus 20 years to be served consecutively, which means he has to finish whatever life without parole term. And then he starts the 20 years. Or if the life without parole goes away, he still has 20 years that he's got to start serving. That was on January 26, 1994. At direct appeal, Kolbicki was represented by Barry L. Warnken and Jane R. Harvey on briefs. The state was represented by David P. Kennedy and Joseph J. Curran Jr. and Sandra A. O'Connor were served on brief. The court was before the Maryland Court of Special Appeals. It was docket number 190 during the September term of 1994. And remember, you know, with Adnan Syed, Maryland had the Court of Special Appeals, which was the intermediate appellate court, which would be the equivalent in Louisiana to the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth circuit courts of appeal. It would be the equivalent in the federal circuit to the first through 11th circuits. It's the intermediate court of appeal.
Right. Yep.
They rendered their decision on December 1st, 1994. Defendant sought review of a decision of a circuit court for Baltimore County, Maryland, which convicted defendant of first-degree murder and use of a handgun in the commission of a felony. On appeal, defendant contended that it was reversible error to permit the state to offer as rebuttal evidence hearsay testimony of an alleged admission of defendant, and then having admitted that rebuttal evidence, to deny defendant the opportunity to testify on sir rebuttal. According to defendant, the state rebuttal witness's testimony was improper rebuttal evidence because it did not contradict any new matter introduced by defendant. The court found that on its face, the testimony of the rebuttal witnesses offered by the state did not appear to be rebuttal testimony. As a result, the rebuttal testimony created a strong inference that defendant had conspired to deceive the trial court in order to exculpate himself. Because that inference was injected into the case as a result of the rebuttal testimony, the court concluded that it constituted new matter and that defendant should have been given an opportunity to explain to the jury on sir rebuttal. Allowing the state to present the incriminating rebuttal testimony at the close of the trial without giving defendant an opportunity to deny that he was involved was error. The court reversed the judgment of the trial court and remanded the case for a new trial. So, and the rebuttal testimony didn't say anything about Kulbicki. It was just the scheme. And I think they were very they told the witnesses to be very careful not to mention Kulbicki. But the appellate court found that that was crossing a line.
Even just mentioning him was too much.
Yeah.
And it was a little nitty, but I get it. I guess I sort of understand.
And I kind of wish that the court had given him a chance to testify on sir rebuttal, because he would have just talked himself right back into the hole. Okay. I think there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that he would have talked himself into a guilty verdict.
Right.
In spite of the sir rebuttal. And then I don't think there would have been any grounds for them to have reversed that first conviction until later, as we'll discuss later. Okay. So then he goes for a retrial because the Maryland Court of Appeals, which was the highest court in Maryland, they've since renamed themselves. They're now the Maryland Court of Appeals, or Appeals Court of Maryland, and the Maryland, I think they call themselves the Supreme Court now. So they've renamed themselves as of 2021 or 2022. Because it does get confusing. But they were, Court of Appeals was actually the highest court, and Court of Special Appeals was the intermediate court. They denied the state's petition for writ of certiorari on March 23rd, 1995. So then the retrial, Patricia Hall was first chair. John Frank was second chair. The judge was Barbara Kerr Howe. Kulbicki's trial was held from November 13th to November 22nd, 1995. And I'm just going to go through and kind of summarize the evidence presented against Kulbicki, because I think it's important to look at it, to put it in context for later events that happened. Walter Kutcha was walking his dog near the archery range at Gunpowder State Park when he saw a body lying by one of the trash cans. Suspecting foul play, he went to a park ranger's cabin and came back with the ranger. Upon their return, Kutcha and the ranger discovered the body was that of a deceased woman lying on her back. Detective William Ramsey, a member of the Baltimore County Police Department's Homicide and Missing Persons Unit, arrived at 10:18 a.m. and began his investigation. He observed blood on the victim's forehead, around her nose, and on the right side of her shoulder. Detective Ramsey also noted that the victim's jewelry had not been removed. Upon turning the body over, he saw a wound near the back of the victim's head, but no blood on the ground underneath. Based on the leaves and debris, under the victim's jacket, the position of her clothes and arms, the disturbance of the leaves and debris in an area leading toward the body, as well as the absence of bullets and shell casings on the surrounding ground, Detective Ramsey concluded that the victim had been killed somewhere else and taken there and dragged there and dumped. Detective Ramsey unzipped the victim's jacket and found a Royal Farm store smock with a name tag that said Gina. He made inquiries and found out that at the time, Baltimore City was looking for a missing woman named Gina who didn't show up for work at Royal Farms. Gina's mother, Geraldine, testified that she last saw Gina on Saturday at 3:30 p.m. when Gina left for work. At about 4:10, Geraldine received a call from Gina's employer stating that she never arrived. During Detective Ramsey's investigation, he received information over the radio that there was an individual who might have some information relative to the crime. Detective Ramsey sent an officer to interview that witness, whose first name is Barbara. I'm not going to mention her last name. At trial, as a witness for the state, Barbara testified that at approximately 3 p.m. on January 9th, she and her son went to the archery club at Gunpowder State Park. As they were leaving the parking area around 4:40 p.m., she saw a black Ford pickup truck coming down the road with its headlights on. When the truck turned into the parking area, it passed parallel to Barbara's vehicle about 4 feet away. With her window down, Barbara raised her hand, yelled, and said hi. The driver of the truck slowly looked at her full face, but did not respond. Barbara identified the driver as Kulbicki. Now, she identified the driver later as Kulbicki when she saw a news report about his arrest. But she described dark-haired male in his 30s or 40s by that time. In his 30s. At the time she gave the initial on the day Gina's body was found.
Did she give a different, did she give anything in that initial identification that would have been contradictory?
There's a show called Reasonable Doubt, and it showed a snippet of a statement that was allegedly from Barbara talking about two people in a red car and a woman who looked like she was passed out or unconscious in the back seat. But I don't have that actual statement. And given the tendency of some television producers to misrepresent facts, she may have also described seeing a red car and these things, but that's not all she described.
Gotcha.
And again, it was established at trial that her main statement, her initial statement, talked about the black truck. She may have also talked about a red car, but she talked about the black truck as well. So, shortly after Detective Ramsey concluded his investigation at the park, he received information that prompted him to visit the home of James Kulbicki, a sergeant of the Baltimore City Police Department, to ask questions about Gina. Detective Ramsey was accompanied by his partner, Detective Robert Kappel. Kulbicki told the detectives that he did know Gina and had been friends with her for about 4 years. Without prompting, Kulbicki added that he and Gina were very good friends, although they've never had a sexual relationship. And that tells me he's denying something before he's even asked.
Yeah, that's, we say it all the time. That's where I feel like when they start to lie at the beginning, you're like, I don't trust you. Just, if you're ever accused of something that's, a murder, just be honest. Even if it's going to get you in trouble, because once you start saying, oh, I've never had sexual relationships with that woman, and she's literally has your child.
Right, exactly.
We don't believe you.
Two paternity tests, 99%.
Yeah, it's like,
you're the
dad.
It's
not even in question.
Kulbicki,
it's like she has a child. Like, it's not
Kulbicki's,
even a question.
In Kulbicki's defense, he doesn't believe in DNA. And because they both have Slavic backgrounds, which I don't think Nielsen is German, if anything. So I don't know where he's getting that she's that he's got a slot that she's Slavic. I mean, her mother Gerhardt and Nielsen
Yeah,
sound more German than anything else.
like seriously. This guy's a piece of
So
work.
yeah, he is. He's a manipulative, lying sack of crap.
Like, I've never had sexual relations with that woman, but we have a child together.
Yeah. Kubicki stated that he last saw Gina at around 3:30 p.m. on Friday, January 8th, 1993, when he picked her up close to her house and drove her to work. Kubicki also stated that he last spoke to Gina when she called him on Friday night at midnight or into early Saturday morning. When Detective Capel informed Kubicki that Gina's body was found in Baltimore County, Kubicki said he suspected that was the case because the detectives admitted they were from the homicide squad. Kubicki did not ask where and how Gina was killed, according to Detective Capel. Kubicki just said he didn't have anything to do with it. Now, one of the detectives on that reasonable doubt program also described something he witnessed while he was in the house talking to Kubicki. Apparently, his wife said something, and Kubicki said something like, "You shut your fucking mouth. I'll tell you when to talk." When she tried to ask a question or provide an alibi for Kubicki. So that's where I get them controlling and domineering from. The detectives asked Kubicki about an upcoming paternity hearing scheduled for the following Wednesday, as well as genetic tests indicating Kubicki was the father of Gina's 18-month-old child. In response, Kubicki said, and I quote, "Well, that's absolutely impossible that I'm the father. I don't believe in genetic tests. And the only reason why they'd even be close is because we're both Slavic. I never had sex with her." Okay, so this is how manipulative he is. And he thinks because he's a Baltimore City police officer, his word is sacrosanct.
And so I'm sorry. I'm just trying to maybe I miss it. Like she's already had the first baby, right? Okay. So like she has a child and he's saying, okay, he's crazy.
And two
I was just like
DNA.
it seems so crazy. It's like I feel like I need to re-ask. Like I thought you said Michael was born and then she had an abortion. So like I feel like they've had a child and almost had a second one and he's denying they had sex. This guy's like great. He's fantastic.
And again, beating a dead horse here, but two DNA tests,
Right.
two paternity tests,
Yeah, I mean, like literally
99%
the
that he is
paternity
Michael's
the
father.
paternity test is walking around. Like his name is Michael. He has a name.
You might say what you want about the first one because he said he didn't trust that one. That was probably done by, like a city contractor. But then the second one was Johns fucking Hopkins.
Right.
I mean, you can't get any more highbrow than Johns
Yeah,
Hopkins
exactly.
to do your second DNA test
Right.
at apparently great cost. Detective Patrick Camberger, a crime lab mobile technician with the Baltimore County Police Department, processed Kubicki's truck on January 11th, 1993. Detective Camberger testified that the truck, a 1988 Ford F-250, had a filthy exterior, but inside the truck appeared to be clean. The first thing he noticed when he opened the door was a smell of household cleaner. According to Detective Camberger, there was no surface dust on the dashboard or around the steering wheel, and the floorboard underneath the driver's floor mat was damp, although the mat itself was dry. Detective Camberger noticed that a piece of red plastic molding was missing from the rear passenger side window, revealing a rubber strip that had metallic marks. Beneath the rubber strip, Detective Camberger noticed an impact area or indentation. Subsequent chemical testing of the rubber strip established that the rubber was struck by something made of lead. A piece of red plastic fitting the damaged molding area was found in the truck bed. Inside the cab, there was no blood visible to the naked eye. Preliminary examination of the truck using ultraviolet light, however, indicated the possibility that blood stains were present. Therefore, Detective Camberger requested the assistance of a serologist from the Maryland State Police Department. A serologist, Matthew Abbott, was accepted by the court as an expert in the area of forensic serology. He testified that 14 blood stains were found on 7 areas of the truck, including the driver's side door, floor mat, seat belt, bench seat, rear floor mat, and underneath the rear floor mat. According to Abbott, the stains found on the cloth seat belt, the seat belt's plastic cover and tags, bench seat, underneath the bench seat, and under the rear floor mat were human and bore genetic markers consistent with the victim's blood and inconsistent with Kolbicki's, which also would rule out Kolbicki's claim that they share the same ethnic background and therefore their DNA is close. Additional stains on the seat belt patch, bench seat, back of the bench seat, rear bench seat, and rear floor mat indicated human blood, but further testing was not possible. Similarly, due to the small samples found on the driver's side door and floor mat, Abbott was able to detect the presence of blood on those areas, but could not conclude anything further. The denim work jacket seized from Kolbicki's hall closet had what appeared to be blood stains clearly visible on the left sleeve. Detective Kappel testified that when Kolbicki had reviewed the list of property being taken, he asked, "The jacket that you're taking, is that my jean work jacket?" Kolbicki did not ask about any of the other items. Linda Watson, a forensic chemist supervisor at the biology DNA unit at the Maryland State Police Crime Lab, stated that the extracted DNA from the blood stain found on the jacket. After processing the sample, they concluded that the DNA type obtained from the blood stains on the jacket matched the DNA profile developed from the blood of Gina Marie Nielsen. According to Watson, the probability of a random match in the Caucasian population was 1 in 7 million. Assistant medical examiner James Locke testified that he performed an autopsy on the victim at 9 a.m. on January 11, 1993. Locke stated that the victim, a 22-year-old white female, died of a contact gunshot wound to the head and that the manner of death was homicide. According to Locke, the abrasions on the victim's body and the condition of her clothing were consistent with having been dragged over the ground. Although the time of Gina's death could not be precisely determined, Locke stated that a time of 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, January the 9th, is consistent with his findings. Locke testified that the fatal bullet traveled diagonally from front to back and left to right through Gina's head. The entrance wound had a keyhole fracture indicating the bullet entered at a very sharp angle and directly perpendicular to the skull or to the scalp. Therefore, a portion of the skull entered into the brain and also a portion of the skull may have exited from the body. There was also an exit wound from which a piece of bone or a piece of the bullet had exited from the scalp. A fragment of the bullet was recovered from one side of the brain. Locke added that evidence of burning on the margin of the entrance wound indicated that the barrel of the gun was placed directly against the victim's head. Extensive bleeding and bruising under the scalp and the right side indicated that Gina's head had hit a hard surface. According to Locke, evidence from the autopsy was consistent with the passenger of the car being shot by a driver. While police searched Kolbicki's vehicle, they found a small object near the rear passenger seat. Subsequent testing established that its major components were calcium and phosphorus, the major components of bone. The fragment also contained some lead. While vacuuming the truck, the police found 3 other bone chips and a smaller bone fragment. Dr. Douglas Owsley, a curator and division head for the Department of Anthropology at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History, examined the larger bone fragment using a stereo zoom microscope. and determined that it was part of the outer layer of a human skull. According to Dr. Owsley, fractured edges indicated that a tremendous amount of traumatic force caused the avulsion of this bone fragment. In addition, the presence of embedded lead and carbon deposits was consistent with a contact gunshot wound. Testing of the smaller bone chips also revealed metallic particles embedded in the bone, as well as soot deposits and avulsion fracturing. Dr. Karen Quant, a senior molecular biologist who was submitted as an expert in DNA profiling, testified that she performed RFLP DNA testing on the skull fragment and PCR DNA testing on the three bone chips. Four of the seven bone band patterns revealed by the RFLP testing matched those of Gina. Because other bands could not be visualized due to sample degradation, Quant testified only that Gina could not be excluded as the source of the bone fragments. PCR testing, which can be performed on smaller or more degraded samples, likewise indicated that Gina could not be excluded as the source of the bone chips. According to Quant, the frequency of PCR type found in the bone chips was 1 in 640 among Caucasians. Now, I am omitting the testimony that was also admitted regarding comparative bullet lead analysis and the testimony for regarding ballistics admitted through Joseph Capara, who was an expert with the Maryland State Crime Lab, for reasons that we'll talk about more in depth a little bit later. But this is the evidence in the absence of that
connected it to him.
Yeah. And this is the evidence that connects him, I think, beyond any reasonable doubt, even without ballistics linking it to his gun or bullet lead analysis. And all that testimony did was link the 38 caliber off-duty weapon as the weapon that killed Gina. As we know from other cases, you don't have to produce a murder weapon for a conviction to remain or a conviction in a murder case. So Kulbicki was found guilty on November 22nd, 1995, both again of first degree murder and use of a handgun in the commission of a felony. And he was once again sentenced to life without parole plus 20 years. His direct appeal went back to the Maryland Court of Special Appeals. And the issues that he raised before the Court of Special Appeals were the following. Did the trial court err in admitting irrelevant and prejudicial evidence? Unfortunately, I don't have the brief to know exactly what this supposedly irrelevant and prejudicial evidence might have been. Did the trial court err in admitting evidence that defense alibi witnesses failed to come forward and provide their information to police? Did the trial court err in admitting hearsay evidence, which probably dealt with Gina's outcry that she was afraid of Kulbicki or that she seemed afraid of him or was afraid of him, or that she identified him stalking her, etc.? Did the trial court err in permitting improper evidence and rebuttal concerning certain vials of blood and in denying appellant's request to submit one of those vials for testing? And did the trial court err in repeatedly permitting the state to require appellant to testify that witnesses whose testimony was inconsistent with his were mistaken? And this is at the second trial, Kulbicki testified. And I wish there was some.
He actually took the
stand. He took the stand. Yeah. And I don't think he did in the first trial, but he did in the second trial. His conviction was affirmed on March 22nd, 1996, with no opinion, and the Court of Appeals denied cert on April 9th, 1997. And that was during the 1996 September term. Then Kulbicki moved on to state post-conviction, which took many, many years. He actually, I think the state post-conviction started while his writ to the Maryland Court of Appeals was still pending. The Baltimore Circuit Court was where he challenged his collateral attack on his conviction. He was represented by John Wendell Gordon in April of 1997, and then an attorney by the name of Michelle Nethercott enrolled in 2006, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. Now, at some point post-conviction, the state did additional testing on some or all of the bone fragments. I'm not sure exactly when that happened because it's referenced in a decision, but it's not actually, a date is not given for when that happened. But sometime between after his direct appeal, the bone fragments were tested and there was a conclusive link to Gina. May have been STR testing in the early 2000s. It may have been PCR testing in the later 90s. I'm not quite sure. So there were several petitions filed. There were two pro se petitions filed in February and March of 1997. Kulbicki also made a FOIA request to the FBI seeking records about comparative bullet lead analysis. The FBI produced a single page to him on July 12th, 1999. And then on January 4th, 2001, Kulbicki filed a suit in federal court against the FBI challenging their failure to produce records. In response to that suit, the FBI produced 120 pages of additional documents and then filed a motion to dismiss. Kulbicki filed a motion to withdraw his complaint in June of 2001. The court issued a memorandum in order on June 13, 2001, and it did award Kulbicki filing fees paid to file the FOIA suit because the FOIA suit was necessary to get the FBI to do what they were supposed to do when he made the original request. Because he was seeking information about the comparative bullet lead analysis done in his case, not in general. So, and then they, you know, they made their, whatever their reasons for not producing the records. And I'm not quite sure what those were, because I don't have the pleadings, but, anyway, so during the 1990s and the early 2000s, people began questioning comparative bullet lead analysis, which was only being done at the time by the FBI. First question was an article in 1991. Then another, a retired FBI analyst, authored a second article in 2002, which called the it called the methodology into question and the manner at which the FBI analysts were drawing their conclusions into question. And then the National Research Council was asked to examine the methodology. They issued an article in 2004, basically finding that there were mistakes made.
This particular case, but just overall?
In comparative bullet lead analysis overall.
Got it.
So the FBI in 2005 discontinued performing CBLA. It was declared inadmissible in Maryland in 2006. And in 2008, the FBI actually sent a letter to Maryland state attorneys regarding the flaws in the analysis that had been done. And flaws in the testimony of their analysts who testified in these various trials. And then in 2007, Joseph Capera, a defense attorney preparing, basically representing two different defendants who had Joseph Capera appearing in each of their trials, noticed inconsistencies in Capera's testimony regarding his academic qualifications. She did some digging. She reached out to Capera. Capera provided her with a falsified transcript, which further contradicted his testimony in these other trials. Questions began being asked about Mr. Capera. He ended up retiring from the Maryland State Crime Lab and then committed suicide on March 1st, 2007. He did lie about his academic degrees. He had no academic degrees, but he claimed to have an engineering degree and another biochemistry degree. And really, when what he was doing is not a degreed, there's no degree for ballistics. It's basically hands-on doing the job.
Right. Yeah, you don't really need a degree.
You don't need a degree, yeah. But he was bolstering himself. And unfortunately, he never explained why he would do this. It was wrong, absolutely. No doubt about it. The comparative bullet lead analysis, I think, is more hindsight determined that it wasn't as accurate as it was made out to be. But again, as far as Kobicki's case, these weren't the sole pieces of evidence linking him to Gina's murder. And I would say the strongest evidence against him is the genetic evidence in his truck and on his jacket linking the blood on the in and on those items to Gina. That's the strongest evidence of Kobicki's guilt. So on November 2nd, 2005, Kobicki filed an amended petition and a second amended petition. I think that was 2004. Anyway, he filed amended petitions really challenging Capera and are challenging CBLA. He supplemented his position in 2006. And again, unfortunately, I don't have any of these documents, so I don't know exactly what they were. But the grounds that he raised were knowing use of perjured testimony, use of unreliable and unsupported scientific evidence, ineffective assistance of counsel, and failure to disclose exculpatory evidence.
Every counsel's insufficient. That's like the general. I love that one. It's like everybody files their appeal on ineffective counsel.
And ineffective counsel, ineffective assistance was that basically they didn't find that 1991 article and use it in cross-examination of the CBLA. A hearing was held in April of 2007. The relief was denied by the trial court on January 2nd, 2008. And then on October 1st, 2009, Maryland enacted Code of Criminal Procedure Section 8-301, which is basically a writ of actual innocence. Newly discovered evidence that creates a substantial or significant possibility that the result may have been different and that evidence could not have been discovered in time to move for a new trial. Claimant must deny commission of offense and new evidence must point toward evidence of actual innocence. The case went up to the Maryland Court of Special Appeals. They entered an order for permission to appeal granted on March 10th, 2010. They rendered their decision on September 26, 2012, after defendant was convicted of first-degree murder. At two trials, he petitioned the circuit court for Baltimore County for post-conviction relief, which the trial court denied. Defendant appealed. Defendant set his conviction based on comparative bullet lead analysis evidence violated due process. The appellate court held that he was not entitled to post-conviction relief because, one, while such evidence was later found inadmissible, this was no reason to doubt expert conclusions that bullet fragments matched and that bullets defendant possessed matched. And two, criticisms of the evidence went to weight, not admissibility, so due process was not violated. The state's use of false testimony attributable to a prosecutor unaware of its falsity did not require post-conviction relief because, one, claims based on a witness's false assertion of degrees were waived when not raised on appeal. The falsity did not influence the verdict. Testimony was not false when witnesses did not doubt its validity, nor was it inaccurate. Nothing showed prosecutors knew evidence of a witness who was not a state official was unreliable, and a false testimony claim went to credibility and sufficiency, which could not provide post-conviction relief. He did not show counsel was ineffective because they pursued a reasonable strategy. And the argument for that was when Kulbicki was tried the second time, he presented an alibi defense and that he wasn't there. He didn't do it. He didn't have anything to do with it. And that was their strategy. And that was found to be a reasonable strategy. So the trial court's judgment was affirmed. The Maryland Court of Appeals granted Kulbicki's petition and the state's conditional cross petition on February 22nd, 2013. Oral argument was held on October 13th, 2013, and the Court of Appeal rendered its decision on August 24th, 2014. They held a murder defendant's attorneys rendered ineffective assistance when they failed to investigate and cross-examine the state's expert on comparative bullet lead analysis in the 1995 trial based on a report the expert co-authored in 1991, although CBLA evidence was not discredited until 2006 because the expert's report noted flaws with CBLA evidence that eventually resulted in its rejection. Had the attorneys investigated and discovered the 1991 report, they would have had a potent challenge to the expert's conclusion that the bullet fragment taken from the victim's autopsy and the fragment found in defendant's truck were two pieces of the same bullet, and there was a substantial possibility that the outcome would have been different. And so the judgment was reversed, and the case was remanded for a new trial. On October 21st, 2014, the court denied the state's motion for reconsideration, but it did stay its mandate, which meant that Kulbicki would remain in jail. On January 16th, 2015, the Maryland AG filed a petition for writ of certiorari at the U.S. Supreme Court, which was given docket number 14-848. The question presented was, does an appellate court violate the core principles of Strickland versus Washington when it conducts a post hoc assessment of trial counsel's performance based on scientific advances not available at the time of trial? And you got to think about this. What the Maryland Court of Criminal Appeals was saying, or Court of Appeals was saying, was Kulbicki's attorney should have gone to a library and found this article.
That's interesting.
Authored by Peel. That's basically what they were saying. Because this was in days before the internet was really the be-all, end-all.
That's a really interesting. I'm trying to process that.
Brought information to your fingertips. Yeah. Right. So
they're saying, that's an interesting ruling.
Mm-hmm. So the reasons for granting the writ cited by the AG were the appellate court's reliance on scientific advancements and legal changes unavailable to trial counsel is inconsistent with settled Sixth Amendment law. The Court of Appeals' post hoc consideration of advances in science and technology presents important issues not previously addressed in this court's Sixth Amendment right to counsel jurisprudence. And the Court of Appeals' decision is in conflict with numerous decisions of the Federal Circuit Courts of Appeals and state courts of last resort. Kulbicki filed a waiver on February 6, 2015, which basically he wasn't going to file a response to the or a brief in opposition to the AG's petition, probably believing that this was a slam dunk and that the state's petition was going to be denied. The court instead, the court requested a response on the 19th of February and made it due March 23rd, 2015. Kulbicki got a couple of extensions, but his respondent's brief was filed on May 6, 2015, and a conference was held on September 28, 2015, and a decision was rendered on October 5th, 2015. The Supreme Court held that counsel was not ineffective for failing to attempt to discredit comparative bullet lead analysis evidence, since the motive ballistics analysis was uncontroversial and widely accepted at the time of the defendant's trial for murder, and counsel was not required to search for an obscure report questioning the methodology or to predict the subsequent demise of CBLA. Petition granted and judgment reversed, and this was a unanimous decision. The mandate issued on November 5th, 2015. And so then on December 17th, 2015, the Maryland Court of Appeals ordered that a majority of the court concurring that the judgment of the Court of Special Appeals be, and it is hereby affirmed summarily for the reasons explained in its opinion, and it is further ordered that the motion to remand or in the alternative for a stay or supplemental briefing and oral argument be and is hereby denied without prejudice to petitioner pursuing his announced intent to file a petition for writ of actual innocence. Kulbicki then filed pro se a motion for petition for writ of habeas corpus in federal court. He amended that petition, citing his grounds, basically, which were the false testimony and the CBLA, and challenging some of the DNA and effective assistance, because he apparently decided that his attorneys didn't adequately challenge the scientific forensic testimony regarding the DNA and the bone fragments. The court on January 20th, 2017, in light of the court's determination that stay in abeyance is not appropriate in this case, petitioner will be granted a brief period of time to inform the court whether he wishes to withdraw the petition or proceed. In the event petitioner does not timely inform the court of his intent, the petition will be dismissed without prejudice and without further notice. A separate order follows, and that basically denied Kulbicki's motion to appoint counsel, his request for stay in abeyance. He was granted 21 days from the day of the order to indicate whether he wished to proceed with the claims raised in the petition for writ of habeas corpus or wish to withdraw. And he was forewarned that if he didn't announce his intent, the matter would be dismissed without prejudice. And on the 9th of February, Kulbicki did withdraw his request for stay in abeyance, and announce his intent to pursue a writ of actual innocence and exhaust state remedies. So a marginal order dismissing that case was entered on June 29, 2018. And now this is where it gets really annoying for me. For some listeners, it may not be, but for me, it's exceptionally annoying because
he's going to suddenly start telling the truth.
No. He filed a petition for writ of actual innocence in state court on July 1st, 2016, based on CBLA and Capera's false testimony. The state filed a response or an answer on September 28, 2016. And again, I just want to summarize the evidence against Kulbicki that doesn't involve CBLA or Capera. Defendant had an extramarital affair with Gina and fathered her child. Gina initiated proceedings to receive child support from defendant. Despite his denials, paternity testing established the defendant was the father of Gina's child. A hearing regarding child support was set to occur on January 13, 1993. Gina was killed on January 9, 1993. In the days before the murder, defendant had contact with Gina and was well aware of her location and work responsibilities. The day before the murder, he drove her to work. When she arrived at work, she had what appeared to be a slap or grabbing type injury on her face, and she was upset. Gina had recently started a relationship with another person, but was still pursuing child support from defendant. The new boyfriend picked her up from work on January 8, 1993, and she pointed out defendant sitting outside her workplace. Gina was nervous. Defendant was later observed outside Gina's house. Gina left home to walk to work at 3:30 p.m. on January 9, 1993. She never arrived at work, where she was scheduled at 4 p.m. Her body was found in Gunpowder State Park the following day. Barbara saw a person driving a black Ford pickup truck in the area of Gunpowder State Park where Gina's body was later found, and she positively and unequivocally identified defendant as the person driving the truck. When interviewed by detectives, defendant denied ever having had sex with Gina, despite acknowledging at trial that he was the father of her son. The police seized and searched the black pickup truck that belonged to defendant. They found a bullet fragment, human bone fragments, and human blood. They also noted that the interior of the truck appeared to have been recently cleaned, despite the exterior being quite unclean. Mats were missing. The evidence was found in areas that could be missed in attempting to clean. Subsequent serology and DNA testing showed that the blood in the truck was Gina's. The DNA analysis of the bone fragments eliminated defendant, but did not exclude Gina. Police seized a jacket from defendant's house, which he identified as his. Blood found on the jacket was analyzed for DNA and matched Gina. The bone fragments from the truck included a piece that could be identified as a piece of skull, which had been subjected to traumatic force consistent with a gunshot wound. The fragment also contained lead and carbon deposits, which would be consistent with a gunshot. Gina's autopsy showed that she died as a result of a gunshot contact wound to the skull at an angle consistent with a passenger in a vehicle being shot by the driver. Thus, there was damage to the molding inside defendant's truck consistent with being struck by a bullet. So then the Maryland writ of actual innocence article was amended in October of 2017 to define the term conviction as it relates to the standard required to file a petition for writ of actual innocence by a person convicted at trial. And they established the standard required to file a petition for writ of actual innocence by a person convicted as a result of a guilty plea, an Alford plea, or a plea of nolo contendere, and requiring that a petition for actual innocence require a sworn affirmation by the petitioner that the petitioner is innocent. Hearings were held on Kulbicki's petition in December 2017 and January of 2018. A decision denying the petition for writ of actual innocence was entered on February 17, 2018. That was appealed to the Court of Special Appeals on March 14, 2018. The question was presented was, did the circuit court abuse its discretion denying petitioner Section 8-301 petition, where the Court of Appeals previously held that merely cross-examining Agent Peel about the flaws in CBLA would have created a substantial possibility of a different result. That article was amended again in 2018, it didn't have anything to do with CBLA. It actually was to expand eligibility for post-conviction DNA testing. Something Kulbicki has never requested, by the way. A decision was
post-DNA testing?
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, you know, just a minor thing for me. A decision was rendered by the Court of Special Appeals on January 2nd, 2020, and it reversed the circuit court's decision. It remanded the case with direction to issue a writ of actual innocence and for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. The costs were to be paid by the state. Now, this I don't think is right.
You don't think what is right?
I don't think that that's right. I think that there was plenty of evidence not having nothing to do with CBLA that proved Kulbicki's guilt, that to say that there could have been a different result if they more carefully cross-examined or more extensively cross-examined CBLA evidence is a fiction. It's not quite as egregious as Adnan Syed's motion to vacate.
Nothing is.
But it's nearly as egregious.
Right. That's
because
crazy.
Basically, yeah. The Court of Special Appeals ignored all of this other evidence of guilt that has nothing to do with CBLA.
I mean, I don't know if you know, just a random question. Do you know how how close was this murder scene to the Heyman Lee murder scene? Is it close or is it a ways away? I know they're both in the Baltimore area, but just curious.
I think Gunpowder and Lincoln are two different parks. Let me see. Let me open a Google window right now just to
I was just curious if they were.
Yeah. Okay.
Sort of.
Let me see. Let's do it this way. From Gunpowder State Park to Lincoln. Okay. Gunpowder is on Grace's Quarters Road in Middle River. And Lincoln is at 4921 Windsor Mill Road. They are a little bit of ways away. They're about 40 minutes away, 32 miles.
Yeah, it looks like Gunpowder is kind of way, way out there, kind of on the water.
Yeah.
Right? Like...
Yeah. Gunpowder is, yeah. And Lincoln is closer to,
more the city center, right?
Yeah. So, they're kind of, I mean, they're each a little bit of ways from Baltimore proper. So, but, they're a little bit of ways away. So anyway, so he got his writ of actual innocence. The state filed a petition to the Court of Appeals, which was denied on April 24th, 2020. So that decision became final. Also, interestingly enough, in July on June 7th, 2021, the Court of Appeals also held that in Hunt versus State, in this case and in all similarly situated Capara cases, trial counsel were not expected reasonably to uncover Capara's deception before 2007 in the absence of specific information that should have put counsel on inquiry notice to investigate sooner Capara's background. So I don't know whether that I'm not. They just made a ruling. So but I think they eventually made it easier for people to challenge if Capara was involved in their prosecutions, because there's a whole slew of criminal cases after Hunt that challenge the testimony through writ of actual innocence. So, Kobiki is facing his third trial, and hopefully the third time will be the charm. The state has filed a notice of intent to seek life without parole on November 18th, 2021. Kobiki filed various motions for discovery, inspection, motions to suppress and exclude evidence. 1993.
Golly, I cannot. It's like crazy. Yeah. It's 20 years. He's still.
Yeah. 30 years.
I know. It's unbelievable how much 30 years now. Defendants.
And motion for speedy trial. That was on March 1st, 2022. April hearing dates, June pretrial conference, and July 2022 trial dates were continued in March of 2022. There was a request for bail review in August of 2022, which was denied on August 31st, 2022. So Kobiki is still at Western Correctional Facility in Maryland. He's still being held. A continuance of March 2023 trial dates was granted in January of 2023. A scheduling conference was held. Trials was scheduled again in January and February of 2024. The state produced discovery in December of 2023. A pretrial conference was held on January 12, 2024. And then on January 18th, a continuance was granted. So Kobiki's trial, which was scheduled for January and February of 2024, has been continued. And that is where we stand. His trial was continued, and no new trial date has been set as of yesterday when I was typing my notes, because I checked. So, yes, 20 years later, he's being retried. He's trying to claim that he's innocent, that he had nothing to do with Gina's murder, and that some other dude did it. And basically, if you have ID, if you have Max, you can watch ID programs and Reasonable Doubt. It was, I think, the first or second season. I think it was the first season, like episode 4. His wife and son appear on that episode, and they try to argue his innocence.
Well, and speaking of that, I know the world is funny, like all these things. I had not thought of Terry Garr in 10 years, the American actress, but I was looking. Apparently, there is a Lifetime movie that came out in 96 called Double Jeopardy, and Terry Garr plays the victim.
No. Terry Garr played his wife.
Yeah. Right.
Brittany Murphy, the late Brittany Murphy played the victim. The names were changed.
Yeah, from Clueless fame. Yes, that's right.
But yeah, she played the victim. Joe Penny played Kobiki's, or the character that is Kobiki.
Yeah, Dabrowski.
They got then
the Polish stuff going
another
on.
Another Baltimore native who was on Southland. I can't remember his name at the moment. He played the son, the stepson. It's actually, you know, I mean, it was a pretty good movie. Reasonable Doubt was in 2017. So Reasonable Doubt was in the period while Kobiki was pursuing the writ of actual innocence,
right
before it was granted. But it is a good, and it's a good thing. And I think if you watch it, you get to hear some of his manipulation. You get to hear about the case against him. And you kind of get to hear how desperately ridiculous the claims are. For one of the claims is that there was some impropriety with the blood vials, where it's probably just literally a mistake on the part of the medical examiner's office. Because one of the things is they claim they spread, they planted the blood in his truck from a blood vial. That was the testimony at trial and rebuttal of that theory.
Yeah, that was a great conspiracy. Everything is a conspiracy.
And then the bone fragments, they challenged. They're like, well, they weren't determined to be human, which is a lie. They were determined to be human by the Smithsonian.
You said this earlier. I mean, my favorite thing on all these cases is, you know, it's like the same people are like, these cops are so stupid. They can't execute a basic investigation, but they're also super geniuses and can craft a magical conspiracy theory and frame anybody. Like, it can't be, it's got to be one or the other. It can't be both. Like,
yeah.
They're either incompetent or they're geniuses.
And, you know, the other funny thing is, well, I'm the only person they ever talked to. Well, yeah, dude, because you're the one who had an affair with her. You're the one who's going to have to pony up $3,000. In a couple of days, you're the one who's tried to get her.
Like, I don't know. Are they going to like randomly interview every random person?
Yeah, really. I mean, yeah, that's what they're supposed to do. But it is. It's a sad case. Her mother and father have since died. Her sisters are still around. Her son is still around. Unfortunately, he's another victim in all this because he's... had substance abuse problems and has served time. The family, the parents and Michael apparently moved to York, Pennsylvania, at some time after this case. And so Michael has gotten into legal trouble in Pennsylvania. And then his grandparents died. His grandparents raised him. So Kobicki didn't want to be a father to him, which is horrible. I mean, even after all that, especially if you're not guilty, you step up and you take care of your kid whose mother was murdered by some other dude, not you. But that didn't happen. So... and I feel really bad for Michael.
Yeah.
Because his mother, she loved him a lot. And everything she did, she was doing for him. And she stood up to the loser for him. So, and I think the day before the 8th, I think that was trial run. And I wish after that, when she saw him on the night, she had told him to fuck off and gone into the nearest business and asked them to call the police, because she'd probably still be alive. And that's another thing. Gina was not a bitch. Gina was a good person who wanted to see the best in everybody.
Right.
Because if I had taken a ride from him and he had scared me and then followed me and then, you know, scared me the night before, I would have literally told him to fuck off the next day when his truck pulled up.
Right.
I would not have gotten in the truck with him.
Yeah.
Because I don't need that shit in my life. But, you know, that wasn't her. She was a good girl who... And, you know, I think she fell under the sway of an older man.
Well, yeah. And I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I'm not trying to be judgy for her, but it's, I mean, you do worry. It's like, okay, you have one child that mm-hmm. you didn't want. Maybe you shouldn't.
No,
keep
and
doing
that's not it. No. I don't. When she found out she was pregnant, she wanted him and she loved him.
Fair, but
no.
I mean, it's like, okay, at that point, you gotta kind of stop, right?
To be able to, and I think that was the problem. She couldn't get away from Kobicki.
Yeah.
He wanted a relationship
and
he was going to have
it. Jackass. It's like, mm-hmm. he doesn't want the first child. Then why do you keep, you know, having sex with this child that is going to lead to another one?
Yeah. And he's
like,
a liar.
You guys
and he's
old enough to understand how this works.
He lied about not being married. He probably, when he resumed their relationship, he probably said, "Oh yeah, my wife knows and we're separated again." You know, he lied to get what he's want, what he wants. I would have liked to have seen everything that he ever touched as a police officer be called into question.
Yeah, exactly.
But
He
that
doesn't seem
apparently
like a
didn't
good
happen.
dude.
Yeah.
No, yeah,
That
he's definitely
apparently
a
didn't
crook.
happen. So, but yeah, he will probably go to trial, or he will enter some type of plea. I would expect that the state probably has even stronger DNA evidence now than they had, because the DNA advancements in DNA testing have been so great. But I don't know. And it's really weird because the media in Baltimore is not covering this case at all. So it we'll see what happens. But that's where we stand as of January 28th, 2024 for this case. So that pretty much wraps it up. Do you have any thoughts or questions or?
You know, my biggest thought right now, to be honest to our listeners, is let's go Kansas City Chiefs in the Super Bowl.
Okay. All right. I don't really, yeah, I don't really have, I don't think I have a dog in that.
I'm not going to make fun of the Saints, but I can understand
No.
why you haven't been paying much
Who's
attention to football for a while.
the Chiefs or AFC, right?
That's right. And the Lions and the Niners are playing right now. So it's either going to be the San Francisco
Okay.
49ers or the Detroit Lions. I think the entire nation is pulling for the Lions, who are the only, like, the oldest NFL franchise to have never played in a Super
Okay,
Bowl.
yeah, I'm gonna pull for the Lions, and I'm gonna pull for the Lions to go all the way
All right,
and
then.
win
Well,
the
then we'll
Super
just have to
Bowl,
fight the next time we talk. We'll have
because
to, depending on if I may boycott if the Lions beat the Chiefs in the Super Bowl.
but the Chiefs have won the Super Bowl.
I
They've
know,
already
but they
got
need
their
more.
rings. Let's let Detroit, the underdogs who have never gone, let alone won. You know, let's have that feel good story, because when the Saints won, a lot of people were really happy for us.
No, that's true. Because they all the I mean, the Saints really invented the ain'ts and the paper bag and wearing all that. I mean, they really, the Saints invented this long suffering fans. Fair enough.
And you know, we'll still love Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce. Okay, you know, that's a given. But yeah, I'm gonna root for the Lions, and I'm gonna root for the Lions in the Super Bowl, because they deserve their day at the party.
Fair enough.
And you know, let's let a team who's never ever ever won.
Oh wow, they're killing it right now. As the second
Oh,
half
good, good,
begins,
good.
it's 24-7, the Lions.
Oh, good, 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 good. All right. Well, let's call it a night so you
All
can
right, have a
finish
great
watching
night, Lisa. You
football.
take care.
Thank you so much, Kyle.
All righty, bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Based in Fact, a true crime podcast with Lisa O'Brien and Kyle Evans. If you like the show and you want to know more, you can subscribe to our YouTube channel, find us on Facebook, or follow me on Twitter at O'Brien L. Ann. Kyle and I will return in 2 weeks for episode 3, State of Tennessee versus Janet Elaine Hines. In 2019, Hines was charged with the vehicular homicide by intoxication as a result of striking and killing Nicholas Gallagher, a police officer with the Chattanooga Police Department, on the night of February 23rd, 2019. Hines was also charged with reckless driving, leaving the scene of an accident resulting in the death of another, failure to report an accident, failure to render aid, violation of traffic control device, speeding, failure to exercise due care, failure to maintain the appropriate lane, and DUI. We'll talk about the case against Hines, whose conviction was affirmed on direct appeal in August 2023. Until then, have a safe 2 weeks and stay safe.
Thank you.